Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Today we talk heirloom seeds, and back with us, Jer Gettle. He is the founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. The new catalog is out, and we'll talk to Jer about some of his favorite new varieties, and we'll look at a trial growing project in Jamaica. But first, what do you want to know about heirloom varieties? Is there a seed you'd like to find? Have you had experience with the Baker Creek seed catalog? It's a wonderful catalog. Give us a call with your questions or comments. Number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. Jer Gettle, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
It's wonderful to be here again. Really appreciate it every year, and I'm hoping you're staying warm up there.
Oh, it's a pretty cold day here today. We wouldn't be growing anything outside today in Wisconsin, I can tell you that for sure. But what made winter more fun for me was your Baker Creek seed catalog, which is actually called the Whole Seed Catalog. When I found out it came out, I think it was in December early, I quickly ordered my copy because I know you have limited run, and I didn't want to miss it. And boy, it is, as always, beautiful. Is it changed much over the years? I guess a little.
Every year we work on updating photos and varieties. So every year, you know, like this year, we have about 120 new varieties. So, you know, we always lose some varieties for a year or two, and then we bring some varieties back, and then we find some totally new varieties. And then the other thing we work on is new recipes each year and new stories. So every year the stories in the catalog changes.
Yeah, and they're wonderful. They make for wonderful reading, and I'm going to talk with you about some of those as we move along today. You know, there are probably people not familiar with Baker Creek heirloom seeds, so maybe you can talk about your business.
Yeah, our business was founded actually in 1998. It was a hobby founded in my bedroom, and it started out, you know, very basic, just totally as a hobby business. And each year since then, it took off and grew a little and a little more and a little more. And now it's keeps us pretty busy. It's we ship out orders, you know, all across the U.S. and about 50 other countries each year. And it's definitely we have the two catalogs, and we have a couple different locations, and definitely are always growing stuff year round. We have about 30 different greenhouses now, and then we have outside gardens as well. So at any given day, we're, you know, harvesting tomatoes or, you know, year round, pretty much, you know, tomatoes, flowers, you know, assorted vegetables, you know, year round.
And I saw that there was just completing a new storage facility.
Yeah, we have our new warehouse shipping, storage and shipping warehouse. It's about 10 miles down the road from our original location, and it's about 105,000 square feet, and basically full of seeds and packaging machines and shipping and storage and offices and so forth. So it was just finished this last summer.
Oh, man. It's quite a facility. And your catalog, as I said, it's spectacular. It's over 500 pages. Maybe talk a little more about what people find within the pages of that catalog.
People oftentimes come to our catalogs, they're looking for something, you know, either that they remember from their past or something that's fun and unusual. Some people want to find something they remember that, you know, their parents might have grew when they immigrated over from Japan or Germany or wherever they may have came from. Or, and then there's other people who are just like, hey, I want to grow some cool, you know, maybe some Japanese varieties or French varieties, or I want to grow some varieties that might be local to my area. I might be able to find some varieties from, if they're in California, they look for things that are from their area. But a lot of people just are amazed by all the colors and shapes and sizes of vegetables and flowers and herbs. You know, it's like, I never knew there was pink dandelions, or, you know, I never knew there was, you know, tomatoes in all these different colors, or, you know, all these different squashes, or all the colors of eggplants. So a lot of people just have fun, you know, with everything. And then there's other people that are more particular. They're looking for something from their past or from their history.
Well, I tell you, as I look through it, with the wonderful photography you've got in there, I mean, I want to order every seed. I mean, it's amazing when you see what results from those little seeds.
Yep, it's pretty. It's quite a miracle, you know, thinking about all the diversity. So many people are used to just, you know, like red radishes, but when you realize that radishes come in, you know, multiple colors, you know, you have green radishes and yellow radishes and black radishes and then radishes that are colored inside as well. So it's kind of like just that's just one example. You know, you have radishes that are red inside and purple inside and green inside. So it's kind of like, you know, it opens up a lot bigger picture to what you eat than just what you see in the average grocery store that most people think of as a radish.
Yeah. You know, last time you were on, that was just last year, you talked a little bit about the shortage of seeds. That was from last year. Is that still going to be the case this year?
That seems to have subsided some this year. I mean, people have been working on building up their stocks of seeds. So I'd say overall, most seed companies aren't experiencing any drastic shortages overall this year. There's still certain categories where seed companies are behind, like, you know, cabbage is probably still a little short for some varieties. But as far as the varieties that are available this year, we have good stock on everything. Some of the varieties are still, you know, missing, but the vast majority of whatever we have available in the U.S. right now, I think, is pretty stable.
And your seeds come from a variety of places.
We do. We get seeds initially from all over the planet. People will send us things literally, you know, every day. Pretty much I'm in contact with somebody somewhere. Last night at 12, somebody was, you know, messaging me from the Philippines, for example. And early in the day, you know, I was messaging people in Japan and France and various other places. So people are always collecting and sending us things, and we're always sending things to various places. And then once we get the seeds, what we do is we trial them here, generally on our farm here in Missouri, or sometimes at a couple other locations as well, pick out what we like. And then, you know, we either try to grow it here on our Missouri farm, but in most cases we don't have the room, so we send it off to another farmer. A good portion of them are here in the U.S., but we also have people that grow seeds for us in Japan and the United Kingdom and France and Mexico and a few other places. So it's definitely, you know, we work with a network of collectors and seed enthusiasts, you know, all over Missouri, but then, you know, all over the Midwest is our biggest probably concentration. But then we also have a ton of people growing seed, like in everywhere from California to India, you know. So it's kind of a wherever we find a serious collector of seeds or a serious farmer, we try to work with them and, you know, try to make out a situation that's good for both us and them so we can keep these varieties going.
Yeah. You tell a kind of a cool story about being asked to speak. And I've forgotten where it was now. Something in the Northeast, I believe. And they didn't have very much money. So you came up with an idea. Rather than pay you in cash, pay you in seeds.
Yeah, seeds are always the most exciting thing. You know, it's always exciting to get you know, new varieties of seeds. I always love trying new things. Even things that aren't in the catalog. You know, we have more things in our collections and that we get every year than we can put in the catalog. There's just only so many pages we can put into it. But it's always fun for me to be able to try, you know, new varieties of whatever and be able to taste things and try things. And there's nothing more exciting than walking through, say, a melon patch when you have like 50 different varieties of melons you get to try. It's just pretty pretty exciting to be able to see all the differences.
Oh, man. So growers, I'm just wondering how a person becomes a grower for Baker Creek seeds.
Usually either a large gardener, mostly more like small or medium farmers will contact us. But even some really large gardeners, if you have an acre or two of land in your back, you know, back lot, they can contact us and let us know, you know, what they have. And, you know, we especially look for growers that have a little bit of experience already with seed saving. Sometimes we will get a grower that doesn't have any experience and work with them. But generally, we work with growers that try to have already done, you know, at least on a small scale, even backyard seed saving, and they've learned the basics. And then once at that point, they contact us and, you know, just let us know what they have, you know, how much land they have and their experience level and what they'd like to do. And then we try to match them up with a seed or a few different seeds, or in some cases, you know, maybe many different seeds, depending on their, you know, some of the farmers might have 8 employees and they're already producing seed on a, you know, commercial scale. And then other farmers, it's just like them or them and their wife or them and their uncle or something. So it's kind of a.
So you work with all kinds.
Yeah, everything from, you know, people that grow a single seed for us to people that some of the growers might grow up to like 40 different varieties for us a year or so.
Jerry Gettle, our guest, the founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds, talking about the company and about their latest catalog. You can join in with your own questions or comments. Maybe you've had some experiences with Baker Creek Seed Company. Hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us. The email address is ideas@WPR.org. Ideas@WPR.org. You've been reaching out to Japanese seed companies and also, I believe, Japanese farmers and chefs. What have been the talk about that experience and the results?
Yeah, about well, we'd always been interested in Japanese varieties. They have so much, you know, varieties over there that a lot of people in the U.S. aren't real familiar with. And I tried to reach out a little bit in the past, like, you know, 20 years ago. And I got with a couple of collectors and got a few things here and there. But more recently, like about 5-6 years ago, me and my family traveled to Japan the first time besides a layover. And we were actually able to spend a few weeks and visit seed companies and make a few connections. And it was we were just blown away by the diversity of seeds and fruits and vegetables and flowers that are not commonly seen in the U.S. market. You know, things that they might have developed, you know, 50 or 100 or even a couple hundred years ago that are still not common or not seen at all here. So from that trip, we decided we wanted to start working more with Japanese seed companies. We made several connections. We started up. And then a couple years after that, we started making some connections with different, you know, gardeners and seed enthusiasts in Japan. And a couple of them started working for us, and now they're visiting different seed companies and farmers and growers. And we're sending seeds over there for their projects and school projects, you know, American seeds. The same situation is where there's a lot of American varieties, especially like in tomatoes, that they're not real familiar with. So sharing this cultural information and seeds back and forth, and hopefully, you know, making a more diverse seed supply on both sides of the, you know, the Pacific. So it's definitely some amazing histories and stories on both sides everywhere you go, but it has a huge diversity. But Japan kind of being blocked off, anywhere you have an island, you kind of block it off from everywhere else a little bit, and you kind of develop your own kind of unique varieties that become super unique. And that's really exciting to us because, you know, red carrots, for example, where, you know, the deep red colored carrots are my favorite now. The Kyoto red carrot is, there's nothing better as far as winter vegetables than eating a super sweet carrot.
Bill in Fond du Lac has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Bill.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
Yes, I grow onions every year, but this year I'm going to grow them from seeds, but indoors I started them, of course. I just started them. I have a question, though. In Wisconsin, I live in Fond du Lac, which is about an hour north of Milwaukee.
Okay.
Can I put them in the ground in the fall? Would they grow here, onion seeds?
That's a good question. Do you know what zone you're in there?
It's not quite 5, like 4A or B. It's Madison, I know, is 5. We're just a little bit cooler, I think.
They may freeze out over the winter. I don't know. Do you know if any experience with that, Larry?
Well, on a good day like today when overnight it was below zero, it would be difficult, I think.
Without any protection, I'm thinking if you had them under a row cover or some kind of protection, but to go all onions are about the hardiest thing out there, but the little onion seedlings would probably suffer pretty badly. I think you would lose a lot of them over the winter.
Yeah. Bill, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Jer Gettle from Baker Creek Heirloom Seed Company, our guest today. Tyler Ditter is our engineer. Jill Nadeau is our producer. And Clara Neipert's our on-air producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at heirloom seeds on the program today with a guy who knows an awful lot about them, Jer Gettle, founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@WPR.org. Michael in Avalon, we'll go to you now. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good morning. I'm calling regarding the fact that Jerry used to stock Mercad carrot, and I love that carrot. That was a fine carrot. It did well, and we live down in Black Prairie soil, so there's no shortage of nutrients, and it just thrives like crazy. And you haven't had it in your catalog the last two or three years. I'm wondering what the reason is.
I can't remember exactly, but I know I think we might have had a shortage of seed. I believe we still have some seed, though, in the warehouse. If you send us an email, my email address is jere@rareseeds.com. If you send me an email, I'll see if we still have some. I can send you some up.
Oh, sounds...
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, send us an email out, and I'll see if we still have some. I believe we usually still have a little bit of everything in the warehouse, even after we discontinue it, at least for temporary.
When you mentioned carrots, I was thinking there's a gal who grows carrots, among other things, not too far from your place of business, if I'm not mistaken.
Probably so. I'm trying to remember, but
you've got so many. I shouldn't have put you on the spot like that. There's a nice, there's a little photo of her and a nice little story about her. But I'll find that and I'll refresh your memory.
That'd
on
be
that.
Great. Yeah, I'd love to see it again. So yeah,
Mike in Lake Mills, what's on your mind?
Good morning. I'm just wondering if any precautions are taking regarding importing the seeds here or in Japan? I mean, are we concerned about invasive species or them escaping? Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
On the seeds, they all, like, you know, coming through Japan, goes through a phytosanitary process. Japan has one of the strictest quality control processes on the planet, you know, much more strict than on average, say, the U.S. inspections and that as that goes. So there is a slight risk anytime you import anything, but Japan has probably one of the safest mm-hmm. processes. The biggest problem is when things come in is not the small batches as much as when things come in by the truckload and train car. The train car loads of like especially grain crops, because it's impossible, like when you import, say, container loads of grain, for them to check those loads as well as they do on small bags of, say, petunia seed. You know, a 3-pound bag of petunia seed is much better inspected than a large shipment of, you know, wheat or corn, you know, a whole shipload of it, for that matter, hundreds of containers. So, I mean, there's always a slight risk, but that's one thing gardeners and everybody always has to watch for. Even in, you know, seeds produced here in the U.S., there's oftentimes, you know, a chance of having invasive species in the seed. But we do our best, and that's what every company does in the U.S. in general, is try to keep, you know, invasive species out of the seed. And the seeds are tested for purity. So ideally, you know, we have almost 100%, you know, weed-free seed. That's our goal. And as far as importing, it's all regulated, you know, stuff coming in and out. You know, there's always a risk, but the risk is extremely low as far as, you know, it's the same as, you know, most of the commercial seed on the market has been shipped in from somewhere else. So it's definitely something we are always keep our eyes out for, and we have a team here that checks purity on the ground, as well as we send it off for testing as well.
Mike, thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Carrie in Willard. Hi, Carrie.
Well, it's Carrie, but I'm interested in old-fashioned tomatoes and wondering if I could get a recommendation on a more of a high acid, low sugar. Everything is going the opposite way on tomatoes.
Okay.
So yeah, a lot of people like sweet. For a more acid type tomato, Rutgers is definitely a more acid one. I don't know if we actually carry that one this year. Rutgers is definitely one that's a more tartar tomato. Another one that we carry that has a good old time tomato flavor is called Pantano Romanesco. That's Pantano Romanesco, and it's an Italian one, and it kind of has a rich, you know, classic rich tomato flavor. It's great for slicing, but it also makes it delicious, like either salsa or sauce. It's perfect for any of that, and it does have a really intense tomato-y taste.
There you go, Carrie. Thank you very much for calling. Well, tomatoes, man, the variety of tomatoes, the black strawberry tomato, that one intrigued me a lot. I thought, man, I had to try growing those this year. Talk about those.
The black strawberry was our number one seller this last season. This season, we're a little short on the supply, so we're going to run out early. But that was our number one seller last year. We love that tomato. It's a small salad tomato. And, you know, our most popular tomatoes, both here with our staff and also our customers, are the multicolored tomatoes. People love the tomatoes with multiple colors going on. That one has like beautiful shades of pink and purple, and it has some emerald shades over it all, and some also reddish and orangish shades on it. So it's kind of multicolored, but it's primarily, you know, pink with black stripes and with a deep pinkish red flesh. And it just tastes so good, it's hard to quit eating them. They're like the caller just said, they want a more tart tomato. This isn't it. It's more of a sweet. It has a little bit of tartness, but it definitely tastes like candy.
Another one that caught my eye was the lemon blush. Well, I think it's also called lemon queen. And there's an interesting story behind that. Talk about that.
Yeah, that one definitely, the lemon blush tomato was developed or at least sold by the old Thurburn's Seed Company back in like the 1880s. And we have a whole story of it in this year's catalog. But it, you know, basically was really popular for a little while on the East Coast, but it kind of disappeared. And we were able to find the seeds recently, the last few years, from William Boyce Weaver, who lives in Pennsylvania and who's a seed historian and garden historian. And it was featured in like their 1893 catalog, actually. It was featured in a colored print. Beautiful tomato. It's mostly lemon with just a slight blush, and it has a nice classic tomato flavor. It's a nice sweet tart balance, just a great, you know, medium size overall, you know, fairly early tomato, not too late, not too early, but, you know, kind of a early to mid-season tomato, very productive. And it's one of those varieties that's one of the earlier tomatoes in American history, simply because before about the 1870s, tomatoes weren't real common in, you know, most people's diets. So that was really the beginning of tomato development at that period. It was really one of the earlier, you know, not the earliest tomatoes, but definitely one of the earlier tomatoes.
Yeah, there was a guy, Albert Carleton, I think it was, who developed or who really worked on establishing the lemon queen.
And
out of New York or someplace out east?
I believe in New York. And back then, you know, it was kind of, these were kind of almost considered a novelty crop to working with tomatoes. You know, it was like back then the plant breeders were mostly doing, carrots and cauliflower and things people were more familiar with. And now it's kind of reversed. You know, tomatoes have kind of become the king of at least garden crops.
Yeah, they have indeed, and there's some beautiful photos of the tomatoes in your book, in your catalog, for sure. That catalog, by the way, it's around 500 pages, and it's just jam-packed with photos of the vegetables and recipes and stories, so it makes for great reading. And looking and salivating over every single year. Speaking of salivating, your restaurant has reopened.
We do. We are reopened here on the farm, and we have almost everything comes from either our farm here or locally. Even like our rice comes from here in southern Missouri, and you know, we use the local black walnuts for our dishes. We get local oils as much as we can. Almost everything in the restaurant, we make our own noodles and pasta, and so almost everything is made here. Right now, we're only open Thursdays and Fridays, but starting up in March, we're going to be back open 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, for lunch. Lunch only, basically. Lunch. It's a long lunch. It goes all afternoon, but it's basically when our normal business hours are over our normal business hours, sort of. So
I got to get down there and pay a visit when the restaurant, maybe during the Tulip Festival.
That would be amazing. Yeah, we have two festivals coming up in April and May, so we're excited about that. They're both 2 days, and it's always a spring, such a fun time of year to have guests because, you know, the gardens are looking good and the greenhouses are full of produce and flowers, and we've been planting stuff like crazy, so.
I think there was, I can remember one caller to the show once who said they drove to Missouri for that festival. That was a few years back because they got excited hearing you talk about it. So it's the Tulip Festival in April. And then the go ahead.
Yeah, spring planting festival is coming up in May. And the tulip festival is actually, let me see here, what's the date? I think it's 8 and 9. 8 and 9. And then I believe the other one is 14 and 15, May 14 and 15. So those are the two next festivals we have coming up. And the Tulip Festival won't just be about tulips, but we have all sorts of great speakers coming and music. And they'll be the greenhouses are all full of produce. So we have, you know, greenhouses with citrus, full of citrus, and greenhouses full of various flowers and vegetables. So a lot to see. And then a lot of vendors at both these events as well. So,
yeah, that's going to be a really, really fun time. I mean, you had to, I think you were running it, but then had to stop it for COVID for just a period anyway.
Yeah, stopped a couple of years when COVID hit in heavy, and then we relaunched them again last year. So last year we had, you know, almost record attendance, so as many people as we could fit, that's for sure. So.
Kel in Sugar Camp has a comment or question. Hi, Kel.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if you carry seeds for one of those mini English cucumbers, those little short ones. It would be easy to grow them like on a trellis or even a bush style, but it wouldn't take long to grow because they're so short.
Yeah, we actually don't. I believe, as far as I know, most of those are all hybrid varieties, and we actually don't carry any hybrid varieties, but those do look really appealing. I was thinking about trying a few in my own garden this year just to see how they do and compare them. But I know what you're talking about, but we don't actually have any of those at this point. I'm sure that somebody will develop a open pollinated version that we'll eventually have, but at this point we don't have one.
I'm thinking about cucumbers. You've got a piece in your catalog about the world's most popular cucumber, which is, I think, originated in maybe India or Western Asia. And it's like people have been growing it for 3,000 years.
Yeah, there's some really cool cucumbers, but unfortunately, all our the varieties we have, like that, I think you might be referring to the Bia Alpha cucumber. It's a delicious, delicious cucumber, easy to grow. But right now, I don't believe we might have one or two varieties with bush. We do have the, I think we have the Dar cucumber, which is a bush variety. But it's not really, it's more of a pickler. It's not really so good for, it's okay for fresh eating, but it's not as good as like the little English or Persian cucumbers or Israeli cucumbers for fresh eating.
Yeah. Cal, thanks again. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Vicki in Lake Mills. Hi, Vicki.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I purchased some lettuce seeds to plant as a fall harvest. The Cosmic Crimson and the Austrian one, Forellen Schluss, and then I got a free package of Komatsuna, Old Tokyo. Hardly any of the seeds came up, so I was really disappointed. I planted about 6-foot rows, and just one or two seeds germinated, so I'm wondering if I might have planted them too deeply or some other reason.
Yeah.
And so did you plant them last summer, or you know when you planted those?
I planted them in September, I believe.
Okay. Yeah, there's a couple different things. Sometimes it could be the depth, or sometimes in the summer if it's really hot, they sometimes struggle, but they should have came up. That's a good question. Just send us an email and we'll send you some more seed out. I don't know what the reason would be. I mean, we've got all those growing currently in our greenhouses here, and they did just fine, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes variables, you know, each season and each area can affect it, you know, heat, drought, too much rain, not enough rain, all those. But I don't know. Usually they'll come up through about at least a half inch of soil if they need to.
All right, Vicki, shoot an email to Gair and Jer, and we'll see what happens there. Thanks for calling. Jim in Rochester, Minnesota, your turn.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm interested in growing some celery here. I didn't know if I should start seeds indoors or outside. And number two, I was wondering about some English cucumbers. I bought some cucumbers at Farmer's Market, and they were nice and long and thin, and they fit about 13 or 14 in a gallon jug for making dill pickles. I was wondering, you got any English cucumber seed you'd recommend?
On the celery question, celery probably would do best if you get a little head start inside, but you can direct sow outside. The seeds are tiny and they're kind of slow going at first, and then they take off and grow like crazy. So we always usually start ours inside, start them a little early, you know, kind of like you would a tomato, and you know, like 6, 7, 8 weeks early, and then put them out. And that way that you get celery right away, and you don't get them in the heat of summer, which the heat of summer can kind of make the flavor not as good. It makes them a little more. And as far as our easiest to grow celery, probably overall, is the Chinese white celery. It stays whiter and it makes longer stalks, and it's quicker to grow. But any of the celeries will do fine as long as you have them in cool weather. The white celery, the Chinese white, and the Chinese pink are both a little more resistant to heat than some of the English celeries, which were more growing and growing for cooler climates. But when summer hits in the middle of summer, you know, you start getting in those 80 plus degree days. They'll do okay, but they don't prefer it.
And the English cucumbers that Jim was asking about for pickling, got any ideas for a pickling cucumber?
We have a lot of great cucumbers, but unfortunately, the last year or so, we've lost our English cucumber we had. And we've had trouble obtaining a seed supply, but we are working on a new English cucumber. It's actually not a new one. It's an old heirloom, but we had to trial several varieties, and we're trying to find the best one. Several of them had a little bit of bitterness. So we finally found a new strain, or a new old strain, that doesn't have any bitterness in it. And we are getting that produced. Hopefully we'll have some seed in the next year, but unfortunately at the moment we don't. We do have a lot of good, like the Asian cucumbers, the Japanese cucumbers, which are very similar. They're not quite the same, but they taste very similar. The benefit to them is they are a little more disease resistant than the English cucumbers. The English cucumbers are wonderful, but if you're prone to disease in your area, a lot of the English cucumbers are the first out of all of our cucumbers, the first to succumb to diseases. But they are amazing and they are delicious. But the Japanese cucumbers will outproduce and outlast the English. But again, it's as far as a favorite, it's hard to pick because I like the English, the flavor of the English and the Japanese varieties. They're a little different, but they're both equally good.
Jim, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Steve in Boulder Junction. Hi, Steve.
I have two questions for you. You mentioned the Kyoto carrot, which I'd like to grow, but I looked on the net after he'd mentioned it, and it says it doesn't do well if it's seeded in spring. So I'm not sure how I'd propagate it up here. I'm in farther northern Wisconsin in zone 3 or 4.
So anyway, on that one. Oh, go ahead. Yeah. Sorry.
Oh, my second question was after that, you mentioned that, I forget the plant, but you said it was a hybrid, so you didn't carry it, but you thought somebody would come up with an open pollinated version, and I never knew that you could take a hybrid seed and turn it into open, you know, somehow make that plant become open pollinated. Just wondering what the process is that you go through to turn it from hybrid to open pollinated.
Sure. Yeah, as far as the cucumber or the carrot question first, you should be able to grow them fine there. Basically, you would plant them in the summer. They don't do well in long days as far as when they go to ripen or harvest. So what you'd want to do is probably plant it just before the days start to shorten. So that would be sometime probably around July. And then they're quite hardy. So once you get them going, you could probably harvest them like in November, maybe even December. Even under the snow, you can harvest them, you know, so as long as you mulch them a little bit, you can harvest them even under the snow. So, you know, basically we'd be starting them in the midsummer to even early summer, somewhere right around there, and then harvesting them, you know, after severe frost, like after you've been down into maybe the teens or earlier. You can harvest them earlier too, but pretty easy to grow as long as if you plant them in the spring, they just want to go to seed and they don't want to go to root. But if you plant them in the summer, then, you know, in a couple, about 2-3 months, you'll be getting harvestable roots. The second question, as far as the hybridization goes, most varieties that start out, not all, but most varieties start out as hybrids that they start out from a cross in the garden or an intentional cross that somebody made. And a hybrid, that cross is just made every, an F1 hybrid of that cross is made every generation. and you're just planting that first generation cross. But you can save seed out of those hybrid varieties. You won't necessarily get what you planted, though. So a lot of times it takes years of selection work, like you plant it out over and over again and select for the traits you want, plant out like a large amount of them. You know, it could be as many as you can plant, 50 or 100 or 500 of them, and keep selecting the ones that either come true to the original or something that comes true to something else. You might find something that comes out of it that's even better, or the whole project might be a failure and you have to start over again. So it's definitely something that goes on. The other way new seeds come about is sometimes mutations happen, and that's often quite common as well. You'll be in the garden and all of a sudden you'll notice a tomato with a different color. You know, you'll be in the red tomato area and it's not a cross, but all of a sudden you have a tomato that came out with, you know, a different colored skin or a different colored flesh, and people start saving seeds out of those, and sometimes those come out true, and also sometimes those revert back. But those are the two main ways that people find new varieties.
I was Rodney from Verona called, couldn't stay with us. We have a new beet here that's been developed through quite a few years of crossing and so forth, as you were talking about. It's called Badger Flame is the name of it.
And
it's
amazing beet, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you know the beet.
I grew some the last couple of years and been eating them. They're delicious.
He was wondering if you had them, but I don't think they're making enough seed yet to...
We got about 22 pounds of seed, so we didn't have enough to put in the catalog yet. But we are working on increasing the seed stock on that one. But I think you can get it through, if you search for it online, I think there's a source or two that's currently carrying it. I don't know if they have it available right now, but it's definitely available some of the time out there, and it's definitely worth growing. It's an amazing, amazing beet. It's definitely equally as good as anything else out there on the market. I don't know if it's better than everything, but it's definitely equally as good as anything out there.
Jer Gettle, our guest today, founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. Questions for him, I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. We're talking heirloom seeds today with Jer Gettle, founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. Just speaking of comments, I've got a new blog up on the Orchid Show at Olbrich Gardens. It's still going on to the end of the month. And so I've got a little story with a couple of photos of the Orchid Show that's going on at Olbrich Gardens. It's really, really beautiful. Anyway, if you want to take a look at that blog, go to WPR.org/Larry, and over on the right-hand side of the page, you'll find our blog. It's the Orchid Show at Olbrich Gardens. So, in the meantime, we're talking heirloom seeds. Let's go to George in Platteville next. George, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, appreciate the call.
Well, we've been having a problem with early blight in our tomatoes, and I know that there are sprays, you know, copper-based sprays that you can treat the plants with. Is there anything that you can treat the soil with to prevent it?
To prevent it. Early blight.
Yeah, that's a good question. We usually rotate plants to different areas here and then also grow a lot of stuff in greenhouses and rotate through greenhouses too. So it's kind of a do you have anything, Larry, in particular? I don't have anything other than rotation. And
basically that's what you need to do. And it's hard if you've got a small garden area that, you know, rotating them, you can't just move them a couple of feet. You need to move them a little more than that to get away from it or just not grow there. Or, like I do sometimes, grow them in straw bales, which I have almost no blight problems at all with growing tomatoes in straw bales. But that's all I've got, too. Sorry, George. If there's any way you can rotate or just not plant them for at least a year, I think that could be helpful for you. But that's what I've got. Maybe somebody else has an idea and they want to share it. We've got a lot of master gardeners who listen to this program, and there may be somebody else with a better idea than I've come up with so far. James in Kenosha wonders, he has some seeds he bought from you last year, Jer, didn't get them all in, and wonders if the ones from last year are still good and what he needs to do to guarantee their success.
Shouldn't have any problem. We guarantee the seeds for 2 years, and generally we don't see any decline in seeds for, you know, several years after that in general for most seeds. So I don't think anything in particular. Just keep them at room temperature. As long as you don't bake them in a, you know, 120 degree mailbox or garage, or, you know, leave them outside all winter, you know, as long as you just keep them in normal, like household conditions, or even in, you know, anything below like 90 degrees is great, you know, but you know, if you can keep them cooler, you know, a cool room, a cool dry area in your house will be great. It's nothing for several years.
Somebody else wondered if you are involved at all in the National Heirloom Expo. That comes in the fall, September, I think.
We are, yeah. We're helping host that again this year, but we moved it to Ventura, California this year. So it's moving down to Southern California. It's in mid-September this year for 3 days.
And tickets, how do people get tickets for that?
They can get them on our website, rareseeds.com, and... you know, if anybody has any questions, they can message us too, but you can find them there on the website. That's the easiest way.
Really enjoyed the article that you had about tulips in the catalog. You know, there are a lot of we've been talking vegetables most of the time here, but I think tulips came up once. But tulips have a great history.
Oh, they do. They're a really fun plant, and it's one of the things I enjoy growing. It is kind of a short season. But it's that month in the spring, there's nothing else. There's no time in our gardens where they look so good as that basically that month of April for us here. And that's why we have that tulip festival coming up. We also have one of Europe's or the Netherlands' top tulip experts and daffodil experts, for that matter, one of the bulb guys, long time bulb family. He's going to be here to speak at the tulip festival. So it's going to be great to have him here again. It's always always interesting to learn the story and the history of tulips, but then just seeing the magnificent color each spring is just, you know, fabulous.
And the tulips, you know, a lot of people may think that the tulips originated in the Netherlands, in Holland, but they didn't.
No, Central Asia, and some of them actually are native to parts of Europe too, like in the mountains in Italy. But the vast majority of the big tulips that were developed for, you know, what we know as tulips came from like Central Asia and Turkey. And the Turkish were actually the first people to kind of improve and develop colors and so forth. But then the Dutch really took it from there and, you know, made the thousands of varieties of tulips that are known today.
Yeah. Someone wondered, how can she's not on the internet, doesn't have access to the internet, but wonders if she can still get a catalog and how she could do it.
Sure, just send us a letter to our address. I guess I can give that over the...
Sure.
Give that over the radio. It's 2278 Baker Creek Road. That's 2278 Baker Creek Road, Mansfield, like Mansfield, Ohio, but it's Mansfield, Missouri. Mansfield, Missouri. And it's 65704, and that's 65704. So if they just send us a letter, we'll be happy to send them a catalog out.
Do you take phone calls too?
We don't actually, since COVID, we don't actually have an active phone line anymore.
Okay.
We'd like to get it going again, but we don't have enough staff at this point to man it. So we're kind of behind on our telephone service.
So it's the address is 2278 Baker Creek
Road. Yeah.
Road in Mansfield, Missouri, 65704.
Correct. Anybody that doesn't have the internet or just wants to write to us, You know, that's a great way to, if somebody wants to write, send us a letter, that's a great way to correspond with us, as well as email or, you know, website or Facebook or Instagram, however people want to get in touch with us. Besides phones at this time, we'd love to get our phones going again, but we don't have the staff at the moment. So
and the catalog itself, I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you produce it for that price. I mean, it's like, what is it, under $14.95 or something?
We have the free catalog, and like that's the one she could send us a letter for. If she wants the big catalog, you can get the big catalog. It's on the newsstand at like Barnes & Noble or, you know, a bunch of different Tractor Supply, Whole Foods, Sam's Club, a whole bunch of other stores. But Barnes & Noble is our biggest distributor of the catalog. Mm-hmm. But you can get it at a bunch of other stores too, some grocery stores, health food stores, anywhere that has a newsstand, a larger newsstand usually has it. They have a bigger newsstand, but Barnes and Noble is our number one purchaser of it. It was actually the number two publication for Barnes and Noble last spring for their magazine selection. So,
well, I can see why, because here you got 500 pages packed with information and wonderful photos, and you know it was around $15. It's a pretty darn good buy.
And then we have the free catalog, which is, you know, like 90 pages. So if people want the free one, they can send us a letter or request that on our website as well, and we'll get them the free one sent out right away.
The other day, I was in the grocery store, and I bought what is called hot honey, which is becoming, I guess, a kind of a thing now. It's honey that's been infused with pepper.
Oh, wow.
With a pepper. And I bought some and I tried it out and I just tasted it first and it was pretty hot. But then I put some on some chicken and it smooths it out a little bit, but it's still got that really nice heat. And I thought, gosh, I bet you I could do that myself. And yeah,
that's amazing. That sounds amazing.
Oh, it was absolutely great. And I was looking through your catalog and I thought, maybe the dattle. What is it, capsicum Chinese?
Yeah, that's the dattle pepper would make a great pepper for flavoring. You know, not only honey, but, you know, people are doing this with all sorts of different syrups now. And even flavoring their jellies, you know, jellies and syrups. And you know, anything that, any kind of sweet sauce or vinegar, anything like that, people are finding new ways to infuse the, you know, hot peppers. And each hot pepper, not all of them, but the majority of them have slightly different flavors. So getting that right combination that you really like is really fun to, you know, fun to experiment with.
Oh, man, it was really good. But it's kind of expensive. So I thought, well, maybe I could make my own.
I'm sure it wouldn't be hard, and I'm sure you could come up with, you know, various flavors. And, you know, like the red peppers versus green peppers have a big difference in flavor as well.
Yeah. Well, maybe dattle then. I was looking at that and I thought, well, that one would probably be okay. Let's go to Richard in New Glarus. Richard, hi.
Yes.
What's on your mind?
Well, I'm close to Stoughton, Wisconsin, where they used to do a lot of tobacco growing.
Yep.
And they used to steam all the growing beds.
Yep.
Would that be something that could be used to start seedlings and stuff, having those type, you know, steam the beds? And would that, another question would be, would that take care of some of the diseases that was in the soil?
Yeah. Jeremy.
We actually did that this year for our tulip beds, because tulips, if you grow them in the same area, are highly prone to disease. And we did that for the tulip beds here because we can't move the tulip beds. They're kind of handicap accessible, and we can't, like, go to a different area each year simply because it's in the middle of the village. And if we're going to have tulips where everybody can see them, that is, we have to steam them. The only challenge was with the you can find maybe a steaming machine. They're expensive to buy. You can sometimes find a neighbor. We actually borrowed one, and that helps keeps the cost down, is borrow one with something from a neighbor or a farmer that might have one, and that definitely helps. They also are kind of expensive to run. You have to run them for quite a while to get the steam down to like 8 inches into the ground. But it's definitely, you know, I know some greenhouse operators that use them, and they say there's it makes their production like 100% increase in production simply by getting the disease down every year. They're expensive to run on a large area, but if you just have a small area and you can find somebody with one, they're a great option for, you know, a backyard gardener, if you can find the unit, you know, because the units can cost, they're usually in the thousands of dollars, and the bigger units are in the tens of thousands of dollars. So it's kind of an expensive expensive proposition, unless you can, the best thing is finding a neighbor with one.
Yeah. And in southern Wisconsin, there are certainly many steamers even still left from the tobacco growing peak here in southern Wisconsin, and still growing, actually, for that matter. So those beds are steamed, and man, do they produce the tobacco leaves and plants. Jared Gattle, our guest today, he is founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. And there, you can find the website at rareseeds.com. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Talking about heirloom seeds on Garden Talk today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jared Gattle, founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. They offer over 1,000 varieties of vegetables, flowers, and herbs. So as we talk with Jared, I hope you'll join in. What varieties of heirlooms do you like to grow or eat? You can be part of the conversation. Give a call at 800-642-1234 at 1-800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Mark emailed us, Jaron. He says his family's been planting what they've called Dutch lettuce seeds that produce their own seeds, and they're planted in late fall and harvested in June. And he doubts that's the real name, Dutch lettuce. Any ideas? This is a lettuce seed that's they plant it in late fall and they harvest in June.
I don't know. And is that outside in Wisconsin or?
Yeah. Well, he doesn't say where he's calling from, but I'm assuming he's calling from Wisconsin.
Yeah, I don't know any lettuce that would. It would seem like it would have to be in a high tunnel or greenhouse or something, because I don't know any lettuce that will survive even the winters here in Missouri. But so I would guess he must be doing it indoors.
Yeah.
As far as I don't know what variety it might be, because there's so many varieties available of lettuce in the Netherlands, and whether that even actually comes in there. We do have our best lettuce in the Netherlands is called Gustav salad lettuce, but I doubt it's the same variety. I haven't heard of any with that name, but I don't know for sure.
Cindy in Green Bay sent an email. She's wondering, have you heard of Amber Buttercup? Someone gave me a squash, she says, that was very yummy. When she asked about the variety, she was told it was an Amber Buttercup. Her friend has saved the seeds for decades. Unfortunately, Cindy's went into the compost pile before she knew any better, her seeds. Not had success searching online, but she did find an F1 variety that was somewhat similar in name. Any suggestions for locating seeds?
I believe I've heard of it, but I don't know anything about it. That's a good question. I think I've heard the name, but I don't know if it's still available or anything about it, really. I've only heard the name, but I don't. Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have a source. There's another squash that's somewhat similar. We don't carry, but you could find it online. It's called Lower Salmon River. Lower Salmon River. I think Seed Savers Exchange might have it. They used to, but the Lower Salmon River is the closest I could think of to something that's similar to that.
Steve in Fox Valley has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Yeah, I got a question about the tomatoes. I guess I'm looking for more quantity on a plant, if we could get some for canning and salsa and freezing.
Yeah.
If there would be a good one.
Yeah, tomatoes that can, Yeah, and it all depends on, you know, each garden and each gardener. Some varieties will produce a ton 1 year and then not as much another. But yeah, there's definitely some varieties that will produce more. I'm trying to think of the our favorites. One of the ones that produces big tomatoes, but not necessarily the most, but they you know, each plant produces a lot simply because of the size of the tomatoes. And it's actually one that was originally from Wisconsin. It's the Amish paste tomato. That one will fill a canning jar really quick. It's kind of like in between a round tomato and a Roma tomato in shape, but it's a big paste tomato. That's one of our customers' favorites. My personal favorite, I have two. It's the Korean long for canning, the Korean long. And then also we have one called Pink Fang, which is a long, skinny. For best taste overall is the Pink Fang. And these can produce an incredible amount of tomatoes. But, you know, like all tomatoes, if something goes wrong, you know, the crops can, you know, if you have an incredibly hot summer and the blossoms drop or if it's too cold. But the Pink Fang, for overall eating and flavor for canning tomatoes, there's nothing better in my mind than the Pink Fang. I've compared it with other tomatoes for sauces and even fresh eating. It's hard to beat. But for sauce, it makes the most rich tasting, most flavorful sauce is the Pink Fang.
There you go, Steve. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Ross in Middleton emailed us, and he wonders, what is the definition of an heirloom? Does it have to be so many years old and unhybridized?
Well, if you look kind of like in the dictionary, I don't think there's actually, in general, a definition. It's really strict. It's more like kind of like the term antique. It means something old, something heirloom means something old and something passed down, but it doesn't really have a... You know, there's not really a set year or what it means. It's kind of a term that could mean different things to different people. It's basically just like saying an old variety or an antique variety, the similar words. You know, an antique passed down in my family is basically an heirloom. That's what it is, whether that's from your mother or your grandmother or your great-grandmother. As far as the years go, it kind of depends on a person's age and on what an antique seems like. My kids are starting to think I'm pretty antique, but... some people can think it's like 50 years, but it's really arbitrary because, you know, it's an older variety. But as far as like the years go, 50 or 100 years, maybe. But it all depends on a person's perspective.
Ross in Middleton wonders in an email. We just did that. I'm very sorry. I was going to ask that same question again. What are some new flower varieties that you're excited about?
This year in particular, we have a ton of new flowers this year. The interest in flowers keeps increasing. So, and my interest in flowers and vegetables, of course, increases every year. But one category where we launched a whole bunch of new ones is stock varieties. It's a kind of an ugly name, stocks. It's kind of a boring name, but the stock flower is related to the cabbage family. So the flowers are actually delicious to use in salads or to put into flavored honeys or syrups or in so many different culinary ways. But the stalks themselves come in so many different colors. We've introduced about 12 different colors from Japan this year. And we also have like one or two from Europe as well. But these flowers just immensely beautiful in the spring. They're, you know, they're rivals to tulips, except they come in just after tulips. So basically when tulips are done, the stalks start flowering. And you grow them the same as you would a cabbage plant, but they produce huge amounts of flowers, you know, for that spring season. And they are also super fragrant. But that's my most exciting flower for this year. And then the other thing that I guess that we're really excited about is we have three colors of the butterfly pea, which the blue butterfly pea is the one that people use so much in drinks of all sorts, but also foods and jellies and various other colors to get that bright, like neon blue coloring. It's used commercially now, even in some different sodas and stuff. So to get a naturally bright blue, neon blue coloring. And if you add it to pink lemonade, the blue butterfly pea, natural pink lemonade. The acid turns it pink. So you just throw a few flowers in when you're making your lemonade and heat the flowers a little bit and it'll turn everything pink. So the butterfly peas are one of the things our customers love them. They love playing around with them. Kids love them and anybody in the kitchen loves them. So
what about the cherry flavored petunia?
Petunias are one of those crops that, just recently has been researched more and more for production in a natural cherry flavor it's a natural artificial cherry flavor, I guess you would say, a cherry flavor in a plant that is not related to cherries. So it makes a very nice, like, cherry taste in syrups. It also adds a beautiful color. So if you're putting in like your pancake syrup, it adds a nice light cherry fragrance and also a nice kind of a fragrance to your like syrups and that kind of stuff. And a lot of people also don't realize like the petunia flowers, especially that we have these big Super Bismo varieties, which are actually ancient, not ancient, but antique varieties from like 100 and almost 150 years ago. They discovered these giant Super Bismo petunias, and a company in Europe has kept them alive all these years, and we've got like several colors of them. But they're wonderful also just in salads. Petunias are great. You know, the flowers are perfect for – the greens aren't so good, but the flowers themselves make amazing, beautiful salads, and the flavor is not that much different than lettuce with a hint of like kind of a cherry almond taste.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. A listener emailed, they bought your double blue butterfly pea, number HB276, and researched how to scarify them as suggested for these seeds. They didn't have the best of luck. Only a few seeds germinated. The flowers they did get, though, were beautiful.
So on those, they can be a little tricky to germinate. You can get like 100% germination, or you can get like 10% germination. I think our minimum is like usually 60% or 70%, something like that for the seed. So they germinate generally well, but one of the biggest things is keeping them very warm in that germination process. They're like peppers, but even maybe a little warmer. So you want to put them in the warmest place you can until they start germinating. You can scarify the seeds, like rubbing on a little bit of sandpaper a little bit. But actually what we usually do is just plant them and keep them damp and have patience. Scarifying them will help them sprout a little quicker. But what we do is just keep them damp and put them on a heat mat or in a very warm place and just have patience with them, because sometimes they will germinate in a week and sometimes 2 weeks, and some might still be coming up after 3 or 4 weeks. So it's kind of a slow process sometimes. They don't just sprout all at once like a normal garden pea. They're definitely definitely have a mind of their own as far as when they come up.
Bruce in La Crosse, hi.
Good afternoon. I learned from a woman in Menards about 5 years ago to use cocoa shells under tomato plants to decrease blight. My brother, my sister, and I have been using them since, and they work.
Oh,
that's amazing. Yeah, that's a good tip.
Yeah, I had not heard that before. Bruce, thank you so much. Jacob in Madison, let's go to you.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to call in about the person that wanted to know solutions to preventing blight.
Early blight, yeah.
Tomato patch. One thing that I've done in the past is either use layers of newspaper, which will break down, but it'll keep the blossom end rot from splattering back up onto the leaves of the plant. And the other is using flattened cardboard and spreading that out over the ground. Both the papers and the cardboard will break down and serve as mulch as well.
Yeah. Well, that's probably, thanks, Jacob. That's probably, you know, maybe that's what the cocoa shells do too.
Yeah, that's all. Anything you can do to keep the dirt from getting up on the plant leaves, it definitely prolongs your tomato season, that's for sure.
Jacob, thanks. Appreciate the call. Karen in Bailey's Harbor emailed us, mach, M-A-C-H-E, or corn salad is often referred to as a winter salad variety. She picks as it can pop out under snow here in Wisconsin, she says. Do you know?
Yeah, that's one of the crops. That and spinach are one of the two crops that will grow all winter for us here. Even if it hits down to like 17, 18 below occasionally, it will still, you know, it'll freeze back a little maybe when you hit that really cold temperatures, but then, you know, it just keeps on growing, you know, right through the winter. So one of the crops, like unlike lettuce, which, you know, once it gets down into about 20 degrees, it's over, you know, much below 20 degrees. The corn salad will grow, you know, most the year, except maybe in the extreme heat.
Corn salad reminded me of corn, sweet corn, and atomic orange is one that caught my eye. It's a 60-day corn. And, we can certainly grow. We should be able to grow that in Wisconsin well.
Yeah, definitely. And it's the orange corns are also high in beta-carotene, so they're actually, you know, super healthy for you as well. And they make a great cornmeal for making breads and, you know, cornbreads or muffins or anything like that. And they're also just decorative. They're beautiful to, you know, hang on your fence.
Yeah, they really are beautiful. One that caught my eye was right on the back cover. We're going to melons now a bit, but the Kajari melon comes from India, if I remember. What do you think
of
it?
That's my personal overall favorite. It's on par with anything else for flavor. It's like the Charente melon is also my favorite for flavor. But this is my absolute favorite. We planted some last year, and we harvested them for over 3 months, right at 3 months. I would get on a small patch. I had three or four plants, and I would get basically one fruit every day, sometimes two or three fruit every day for 3 months straight. So I ate off of those few plants like almost every single day, on the average, at least one fruit a day. You know, every once in a while I'd have a day with none, but then you'd get a day with two or three. So it was that's the longest I've ever had melon straight in a row on any kind of melon ever. You know, anything over a month is normally pretty good for us. And that was a 3 month stretch, a very solid production.
And it's not like the watermelon this is more like a, what would you call it?
It tastes like a cantaloupe, but with a little bit of a honeydew taste, but it has a nice musky cantaloupe taste as well. It was also probably almost right at our first producing melon and last producing melon. And they're the perfect size. They're about 1 pound each. So I can go out there and eat one or two of them every day.
I like that. I like how you think, Jer. I like how you think. Japan has an interesting history with watermelon. It goes back a long, long ways, doesn't it?
Yeah, Japan and China both have a long history with growing watermelons. Watermelons came, a lot of the varieties came to Japan from China, and they've done a lot of selection work. So one of the things in Japan that's interesting is Japan has a lot of small spaces, a lot of small gardens and small refrigerators and small families. So they've developed a ton of these little icebox melons. So a lot of the ones we see now commercially available, the hybrids that are out there and otherwise, a lot of that genetics has came to us from Japan. And we got several of the old fashioned Japanese mini watermelons in the catalog, and they're definitely amazing because it's like these little 1 and 2 pound cantaloupes or cantaloupes and watermelons. They have the little 1 and 2 pound in both cantaloupes and watermelons simply because they were developing small varieties long before Americans were, you know, because they've had small families for a long time and small refrigerators. So they want, you know, these single serving varieties in all sorts of melons. And that seems to be where the U.S. consumers are going as well.
Yeah, well, smaller families or lots of people living alone, I mean, that would work pretty well. In terms of the watermelons themselves, what varieties do you recommend for our listeners?
Ooh, that's a tough question. I love watermelons. We have one of our favorite little Japanese varieties is called Kaho. It's a yellow, it's kind of a almost salmon color inside. It's like a salmon yellow, orangey color, can kind of range to peachy shades. But it's about a 2 to 4 pound watermelon, and it's a fairly early little watermelon, very productive, and the flavor is really good. That's a great one for a small watermelon. For larger watermelons, one of my favorites is the strawberry watermelon for a regular, you know, full size, like 15, 20 pound watermelon. The strawberry has probably the most intense red watermelon flavor. If you're looking for that like intense red watermelon taste, the strawberry is hard to beat.
And I want to go back to the recipes a bit too. There are some, I was looking at some of the recipes that look so good. There was a lemon blush pie, with lemon blush again back to tomatoes here, that looked absolutely well, it looked good enough to eat. That's for sure. what kind of, it's a tomato pie.
Yeah, tomato pies used to be more common. I mean, people used to make tomatoes into all different types of dishes. You know, back before we had fruit, you know, 365 days a year in the grocery store, we would get more creative. And I actually had a green tomato pie they made out of like unripened tomatoes. And I ate it here at our restaurant here a year or so ago, and it was flavored up. And our whole family thought it was an apple pie. You know, they season it with apple pie flavors, and I would have not knew the difference until they told me what kind of a pie is that, and then it got me thinking that it wasn't an apple, and I had to figure it out. But tomatoes actually are a fruit, and they make really nice jellies, jams. I mean, they're really more sweet than they are savory when you think about them, especially the old varieties that have, you know, the modern grocery store tomatoes are, you know, they pretty much do taste like a unsweet vegetable. But the old varieties were actually really sweet and were originally used a lot for desserts.
Yeah, tomato jam. Dorothy Rodefeld, rest her soul. She just passed away this about a couple of months ago. I had many a jar of her tomato jam that she made, and it was so good.
That's amazing stuff.
There's a mango melon pie, and it's mango melon. Talk about melon.
Again, back before, you know, everybody had everything, you know, store-bought, people would have to grow these vegetables, especially if you didn't have fruit trees yet in your ground yet, that would take 4 or 5 years to start producing. People would grow these annual crops like garden huckleberries, mango melons, you know, tomatoes, ground cherries, all these instant sources, not instant, but almost instant sources of fruit where you could have fruit in a couple of months. And these mango melons, you slice them and put them into a pie or a tart or a preserves, and they make amazing fruity, melony-tasting pies. It's like they're still nice and crisp as long as you pick them when they're still firm, but yet they have that amazing melon taste. It's like you're eating an apple pie that tastes like cantaloupe is what I would describe it.
So this mango melon, there is kind of a hint of mango in the melon.
Yeah, about fruity, kind of a fruity mango peachy taste, as well as the, you know, the melon flavor and kind of the crispness of an apple.
Well, as you say, Jer, your catalog is available pretty much anywhere. You can get copies of it, or you can order it directly from you, I guess.
Yeah, on our website, people can get it. For getting it quickly, you know, you can pick it up at Barnes & Noble or a lot of any big like natural grocery type store, or a lot of the farm stores like Tractor Supply and those kind of places have it too. So
yeah, I think I ordered mine directly from you last December and gave it.
Yeah, people can't find it. We're glad to send them out. That's for sure. So.
RareSeeds.com. That's the place, right?
Yeah, sure. Appreciate everything, and I hope everybody has a great summer up there in Wisconsin.
Well, look forward to talking to you again, Jer. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
It's always a lot of fun. Jer Gettle, our guest today, the founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. Great to have him with us. We'll have him back again next year, and we'll do this all over again. Monday, Bassam Shakashiri's back to talk about science, and the weather guys will be around to update us on the latest climate and weather happenings. In the meantime, hope you have a great weekend, and stay with us, though. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.